The king is dead. Long live the king. The 2023 king salmon season has been canceled for California and much of Oregon. There will be no commercial or recreational fishing for the king this year. Why? Well, because there are not enough salmon left in the Havas season. And this leads us to ask, can enough salmon be saved to have a salmon season in the future?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Welcome out there to the 1336th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Puerto Montt who are tuned into the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, what's not eating what this year is people, and we're not eating any king salmon. The kings, which are also called Chinooks by those in the know, are those salmon that have been hatched in the rivers and streams of California and Oregon, and which, when of age, migrate down the rivers into the Pacific Ocean, where they spend their working lives, as it were. Then, when it's time, they migrate back up rain-swollen rivers to spawn a new generation of king salmon. But for 8 years in a row now, California rivers did not swell with the rains. There was very little water at all in the rivers and streams. And what little rain there was desperately needed by cities and farms and everybody else, and so there wasn't much water for the fish. As a consequence of what has been called the worst drought in 1,200 years, and the competition for what little water was available during that drought, there are very few king salmon left swimming in the waters of California and Oregon. Not enough salmon to have a salmon season. And so we ask, can enough king salmon be saved to have a salmon season in our future? Well, here to help us fish for an answer, we have John McManus, who is the Senior Policy Director for the Golden State Salmon Association. John, welcome aboard.
Hey, good to be with you, Michael.
Yeah, last time we talked, you were with the Golden Gate Salmon Association, and now you're with the Golden State Salmon Association. They rhyme, but are they the same?
They are the same. I was going to crack a joke and say, yeah, those other guys were no good. I had to cross the street and join the Golden State. But that, they are one and the same organization. The reason we changed the name is that we work on California's salmon issues statewide. Mm-hmm. And some people had the mistaken impression back when we were called Golden Gate that we only cared about salmon in the immediate San Francisco Bay Area.
Yeah. You know, when you were called the Golden Gate Salmon Association, when I talked with you last, I thought about that name quite a bit. And I came to think it really does tell a story that probably a lot of people do not understand with respect to the place that the Golden Gate plays in the California salmon fishery. So I thought, you know, what we would do is spend a few minutes talking about the geography of California with respect to the fish and what relation and what role the Golden Gate actually plays in that geography. So here we have this incredible state that has a huge central valley, and it has the Sierra Nevada mountains, and it looks like it was actually made for wildlife and agriculture. Am I wrong?
No, you're right.
And when before agriculture, it really was a paradise of animal life and fish and wildlife and wildfowl and everything. In the winter, when it rained, the whole Central Valley would turn into a giant lake and made for pretty good spawning grounds for salmon and everything else, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And you got to imagine that if you roll the clock back 400 or 500 years before there were Europeans in California, 200 years, 300 years, whatever it is, there was probably quite a bit of wild rice that was growing all throughout at least the Sacramento Valley. And it's interesting to see that today there's still quite a bit of rice that's grown up there, albeit not wild rice. But yeah, it's rice country.
And that rice provided food for a lot of critters, and there were a lot of critters. I once did a show about the market hunters who roamed the Central Valley hunting ducks and geese for the restaurants of San Francisco. And the way they described it was you couldn't see the sky because of the birds. And I suspect the fish life were pretty much the same.
Yeah, I suspect you're right. People have asked before Europeans, what was the salmon population in California? Of course, nobody knows. I think there's been some guesstimates based on what estimates are of available habitat. But my guesstimate is you probably had on the order of 4 or 5 million salmon coming and going underneath that Golden Gate, through the Golden Gate, which is the corridor they all have to come and go through, that used to come back and go up into the Central Valley to spawn. And, you know, just imagine the nutrients from the ocean in the bodies of those fish taken up and scattered all throughout the Central Valley before settlers, both into the Sacramento Valley and south into the San Joaquin Valley. Just tremendous amount of nutrients to feed the soil and everything else that was growing there. It had to have been quite a robust ecology, shall we say?
Yeah, and of course, over the years, you know, when people moved in and started settling things, and of course, we learned how to plumb things and dam things up, and what happened to the water.
Yeah, we plumbed things up all right. we put dams on every single river in the Central Valley. And for many of the earlier dams, especially on the San Joaquin Valley, they actually killed the rivers. They basically took all of the water. Many of the rivers that feed into the San Joaquin, the Fresno River, the Kings River, Kern, the Tule River, all of them basically were killed by people who put dams on them. By the time they got up into the Sacramento Valley and tried to put dams on some of the bigger tributaries up there, they decided to make the dams quite high, like Shasta Dam is over 400 feet high. Oroville Dam on the Feather River is over 700 feet high. And, of course, when you build a dam like that, it's too big to put a fish ladder on. They did not put fish ladders on these dams. And in the process, they basically took away 80 to 90% of the historic salmon habitat. So the salmon that are left over in California are mostly fall run salmon, which have adapted to reproduce on the valley floor. And they're still with us, although their numbers are getting hammered right now, as you mentioned earlier.
You know, I had a serious look at the graph of the salmon population you feature in goldenstatesalmon.org. And the graph reminded me of a ski run because it's all downhill and there are bumps. You go up a mogul and fly over the mogul and then down into the next swale, as it were. And so it's up and down, up and down. But it's all downhill. Is that really the state of our salmon now?
It is, and I think the question is, can we stabilize it? Can we create a plateau where we can keep at least a minimum number of salmon that can successfully spawn and reproduce, where you don't get genetic bottlenecks, where you still have some kind of diversity across the species? And my sense is we can. We still have the habitat to do it on the valley floor below the dams. What's really needed is cold water in the fall. So when the eggs of the salmon are buried in the gravel and they're incubating, they won't die. Temperatures over 54 degrees Fahrenheit water kill the eggs. So you need the cold water in the fall. And then in the springtime, when the little 3 and 4 inch baby salmon migrate to the ocean, You need some kind of water that mimics a spring runoff, snow melt, to basically move those fish down and out to the ocean. They're pretty poor swimmers. They rely on that runoff, a big bump in runoff every spring, which, of course, prior to dams was the natural way that the rivers would expand in the springtime. And too often in the last bunch of decades, these baby salmon are encountering conditions where they don't have that big bump of water in the spring. It's all been trapped behind dams, or whatever's being released from dams is being sucked up just a few miles downstream to service agriculture.
And so without water, we have no salmon. And this year, unlike all the years I can remember, except for 2008, I think it was, there will be no salmon on the barbecue for Mother's Day. So sad. But that's the nature of it.
It's a real testament to our lack of stewardship of the resource, I would argue. I mean, we ought to have enough water here in California if we handle it responsibly. We can certainly have cities. We can certainly have agriculture. We can have salmon, too. Where we get into trouble is where we have agriculture in areas that do not have their own local sustainable sources of water. And probably the worst example of this is on the west side of Interstate 5 in the San Joaquin Valley. To my mind, these are areas that never should have been put under the plow because they don't have their own water source.
It's a pretty good desert down there.
It is a desert down there. The farmers down there will tell you that, hey, we have our own water source. It's underground, and we pump it. And they have pumped it, and they pumped it so hard that the aquifers have collapsed. And in many areas, you've got ground level that's now 25 to 30 feet below where it was 100 years ago, just from the subsidence that's occurring. One of the interesting things right now is with all the rain and snow we've gotten this year, water is starting to run down those dry rivers in the San Joaquin Valley that were killed by dams. It's overwhelming the dams. And running down into the bottom of the San Joaquin Valley in an area formerly called Tulare Lake,
right,
which was dried out many, many years ago and converted to agriculture. The water is starting to fill that lake back up again right now.
And perhaps, you know, in filling up that lake, percolate down into the groundwater aquifers, which have been depleted, causing California to shrivel up like a prune. And that's really kind of frightening. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. And as I said, what's not eating what this year is us. We're not eating any salmon this year, any king salmon. Maybe we can get salmon from someplace else, but not California, because it has been very dry for a very long time, and the fish did not have enough water. And so we don't have enough fish, and that's the story in a nutshell. But when we come back, we're going to pick up the story of the salmon and see if we can figure out how to keep it going. I'd like to take a quick look, though, at what happened to the Atlantic salmon with John McManus. Right back.
And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back. Michael Olson with John McManus, who is with the Golden State Salmon Association, dedicated to saving the salmon so that we can have another salmon in our season in our future. Not going to have one this year. So sad for all of us salmon lovers and salmon fishermen and everybody who works in the salmon industry. And we've seen this story before, and we've seen it on the East Coast. John, what the heck happened to the Atlantic salmon, which at one time was a very thriving fishery, but disappeared? Why did it disappear completely?
Yeah, same reason that salmon are in trouble out here on the West Coast. Human development. The humans back there on the East Coast dammed all the rivers and streams that the Atlantic salmon lived in, and that was basically the end of the Atlantic salmon. You may be aware there's a few of them supposedly hanging on in the state of Maine. And then you will find them up into Canada and, of course, across the Atlantic, Greenland, Iceland,
Scotland,
Ireland. But, you know, they have a different problem over there. The Norwegians pioneered salmon farms where they bred gigantic volumes of Atlantic salmon. They created huge disease problems, and disease was spread to the remaining wild fish that are still over there. So that's a whole other story, but they've got problems with the Atlantics as well.
Mm-hmm. Pretty much, you know, when you go to the big box store, what you see for sale there, for the most part, consists of those farmed salmon from the East Coast. Is that true?
That is true. Just one caveat. The farming of Atlantic salmon now is a worldwide phenomena. They're farmed not only in Norway and Scotland heavily, but there's gigantic Atlantic salmon farms down in Chile. There's giant Atlantic salmon farms up in British Columbia and Canada. I think there's 11 of them still in operation in Puget Sound in Washington State. The state of Alaska, to its credit, has banned the farming of Atlantic salmon in Alaskan waters, which has been quite useful in protecting Alaskan salmon from getting the disease that is associated with those salmon farms.
Kind of look, Typhoid Mary's in the water then, carrying a disease. They're living in their own muck, as it were, in those cages, and easy to spread diseases in them. And it's not typically what we come to expect when we eat a king salmon. Why do they call them king salmon instead of Chinook salmon?
Generally, they swim around with small gold crowns on their head.
Good for them. They're worth a lot of money, Michael, if you can catch one, that's for sure.
I couldn't resist that one. Of the various salmon species, the king salmon, also known as Chinook, is the largest of them all. You know, big ones will get up into the 30, 40-pound range, which is big. And there are some that get even larger than that. But it's not too uncommon to find 30 and 40-pound king salmon, although most of them are probably in the 12 to 18-pound range. But they're the largest of the salmon species.
So with respect to the Atlantic salmon, what we did is dam them to death, pretty much dam the species to death by damming up the rivers and preventing them from spawning and then knocking off what was left in the ocean then.
Yeah, unfortunately, it seems to be the human condition. We haven't been very good stewards of the environment wherever we've gone and settled, I'm sorry to say.
It seems like we're always cleaning up our mess. You know, we plow into something, steal all of things that we can without putting anything back, and then come to grips with the fact that, boy, we made a mess out of that. Maybe we should try to fix it. And I guess that's what we're doing today, right? We're trying to clean up the mess that we have made with our fishery.
Well, you know, I wish that were the case. Here in California, I don't see giant strides towards cleaning up the mess. I will tell you that the Golden State Salmon Association is in court right now, suing both the federal and the state governments to try and get better conditions in the river for salmon. I mean, why do we have to resort to a lawsuit? Why don't they just do the right thing? And I think, you know, you'll find the answer in the history of California and the fight over water.
And they call it the Golden State for some reason, right?
Well, you
follow,
know.
Follow the gold might... and follow the money and you'll find the water.
I guess that's it. I kind of thought it might have had something to do with John Sutter and 1849 and stuff like that. But I reckon you've probably got the right explanation.
So I saw this, as I was saying in our last segment, I saw this incredible chart that's just, I think it was from 1985 to now or something like that, but it's just a ski slope going down the hill. And it hit, darn near hit bottom in 2008 and then picked up. And there was rain and everybody was happy and then it just fell right back down. So the trajectory of our salmon fishery is not looking good.
Yeah, it doesn't look good. The interesting thing is we've got laws, both at the state and the federal level, that basically say we have to handle our natural resources such that we don't drive native species extinct. And even though we've got the laws, often as not, they're not enforced. I mean, here in California, look at some of the other species in the Central Valley that share the same habitat with salmon. One species that comes to mind is the Delta smelt, a small fish native to the Delta.
It's the infamous Delta smelt.
They're fundamentally extinct in the wild because of water operations in California. Their close cousins, the longfin smelt, are almost gone. Giant green sturgeon, which get to be 8-10 feet in length, native to California waters, they're almost extinct, all for the same reason as the problems that beset the salmon, all because of water diversions, all because of how water operations are managed. So if the humans can make up the rules on operating our plumbing system and create the plumbing system, you'd think we could tweak the rules just a little bit to leave enough for the native wildlife. And we can. It just takes political will. Right now, we've got a governor who's made it clear he doesn't want to rock the boat. He doesn't want to be the one to have to break the bad news to the big water barons in the Central Valley, the big agricultural interests, that they're going to have to make do with a little bit of water. He just doesn't have the political courage to do it, even though he's got extinction knocking at his doorstep.
How does the water ownership work in the Central Valley? I mean, we have private water, we have state water, and we have federal water. It seems like a whole bunch of parties own water in the Central Valley. And that being the case, you know, I interviewed a well driller here recently at the World Ag Expo in Tulare, and he says that they're drilling for water at 595 feet deep below the Central Valley.
They're deeper than that.
There's
wells down there deeper than that.
It's incredible. So, in essence, it's not raining enough to start with for the last 8 years. It is this year, thank you, Lord, but not for the last 8 years. We have all kind of people that want to fight for that water. We have cities, we have agriculture, we have nature. How do you go about allocating water so that each gets what it needs? Or is that possible given the extent of our drought?
It is possible, but think of it this way. Water might as well be gold. It is so valuable.
Golden State.
So who is going to willingly give up gold? Nobody will if they have their hands on it. They're not going to willingly give it up. Once they have it, you're going to have to force them to give it up. Here in the state of California, water law basically says the water that falls on the state has to be used in a reasonable way. And if you're diverting water and you're wasting it, and that can be proven, your right to divert can be taken away from you. But in reality, it never seems to work out that way. In fact, look at the folks in the Central Valley that are pumping from underground. That pumping was totally unregulated. California was the very last state in all 50 states to finally regulate the pumping of groundwater. And it did not occur until 2014. It occurred under Jerry Brown, our former governor. And even at that, he received all kinds of pushback from the agricultural interests who didn't want to see restrictions.
Oh, yeah. I remember when they instituted meters on wells. Oh, my goodness. It's like putting a meter on your bank account, right?
Yeah, right. I want to be able to draw as much money as I can with nobody metering it.
Yeah, exactly. And never mind.
Jerry Brown, understanding the political ramifications, basically set this new law into motion in 2014, whereby those pumping from the ground don't have to come into compliance until the year 2040. So we still have egregious examples of overdraft of groundwater, especially in the San Joaquin Valley. By far, they're the worst offenders, you know, because they're in a desert. Mm-hmm. They don't have their own water other than what they can pump from beneath them.
And, you know, I just see what I've never seen before in California, and that is a dedicated effort to take the surplus water that does fall, and through California's incredible water distribution network, put some of that water back onto fallow farm fields and let it percolate down back down into the aquifers. And maybe there's hope for... I guess that's really what you're looking for, isn't it? Some kind of intelligent design that can put everything back together so that we can have a salmon season and agriculture in cities too.
Well, I'll tell you what I'm looking for is that the people that are operating the major dams in the Central Valley, especially in the Sacramento Valley, operate those dams in such a way that they still have some cold water they can release out of the dams in the fall when the salmon are laying their eggs, and they still have a little bit of water in the spring to release to carry the baby salmon safely downstream. Those are my main concerns. But along the way, since there's such a clamor by the wealthy agricultural interests to get their hands on that very water I'm talking about, I think there's got to be some kind of reckoning in the state where agriculture that has its own local sustainable sources of water should be encouraged. And if you don't have your own local sustainable sources of water, I think collectively as a society, we got to question what's going on. Mm. Let me make a comparison here. When the state of California moved to legalize the growing of marijuana, one of the things they require of those growers is to prove they have a local sustainable water source, that they're not going to kill that tiny creek where they have their growing operation. So we do it for pot growers. We force them to prove that they've got a sustainable source of water. And the reason why is so they don't wipe out nature. But we don't do it for the big almond growers. We don't do it for the big pistachio growers. We don't do it for those folks growing alfalfa throughout the Central Valley. We don't make them demonstrate they've got a sustainable source of water. And basically, they've spent more than what we've got in the bank account.
Yeah, and there it goes. And unlike money at the Federal Reserve, you can't print it, right? If you don't have water, you can't print it up. It just isn't there. So
yeah,
what?
That's right.
So what you're looking to do is to convince the government or somebody to get a handle on this. And the way to do that is to ask if you have people prove up whether they do or do not have a sustainable supply of water to do what they want to do. Now,
that's what. Go ahead.
So it would seem that to be able to do that, you would have to muster a lot of political will, which means the city people, because they have all the political will. Am I wrong?
Well, the city people have some political will.
They have the vote.
But the major agricultural interests in the Central Valley seem to be awfully politically powerful. I mean, consider the biggest single landowner agricultural interest, singular individual that I'm aware of in the entire Central Valley is Stuart Resnick, who's a billionaire guy who actually lives in Beverly Hills. Between he and his wife, I understand they've got something on the order of 160,000 acres in the southern part of the San Joaquin Valley that they grow on while they make more billions. And they give primarily, as I understand it, to Democratic candidates, but I'm certain they give to Republicans as well. And with the money they spread around, I have to imagine that when the phone rings, and the politician notices the call's coming from Stu Resnick, he probably answers that call. I'll give you an example. When Gavin Newsom faced a
just a minute. Hold that thought, because we're going to have to take a quick break. But I want to hear the example of how Gavin Newsom answers the phone. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson with John McManus, who is a senior policy director of the Golden State Salmon Association. And today we're talking about the salmon season that isn't. Sad, sad, sad story. No salmon, no salmon season, no salmon on the barbecue for Mother's Day. Tough luck. Do stay tuned. We will be right back, and we're going to learn how Gavin Newsom answers the phone.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Hey, that's me, and I have on the line John McManus from the Golden State Salmon Association. Why did you change it from Golden Gate to Golden State? I still like the name Golden State because I love the thought of all those salmon going in and out the gate.
Yeah, well, we were actually doing quite a bit of work in the Central Valley, and people didn't intuitively know it because of the word Golden Gate. Right. They thought all of our efforts were strictly just down on the coast.
Well, you know, that's what I thought when I first talked to you folks. But then, you know, I just had to think about it. Golden Gate, what the heck does that have to do with salmon? Everything. Everything. Because that's how the salmon access the great Central Valley of California.
It's true. We've got the southernmost population of salmon in North America. You won't find them any further south than those that come and go through the Golden Gate, at least for king salmon. There may be one or two coho salmon in San Mateo County or Santa Cruz County, but for all intents and purposes, the Golden Gate is the southernmost portal.
Now, is there a salmon season for coho?
Not anymore. We used to have one, but their numbers went into steep decline, and they're now protected here in California.
And so that's what I saw when I looked at the graph at goldenstatesalmon.org. I saw this frightening graph of just going downhill, like you're on a ski slope. You go over a mogul, and you go down, 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 down. You hit another mogul, and you go down, down, down. And it, you know, the end doesn't look good. This chart.
It doesn't, but, you know, if we got smart and managed our resources in a balanced and fair way, which is all we're asking, so we could easily get these salmon numbers back.
So if we call Gavin Newsom?
Oh, so you got to be Stuart Resnick for Gavin Newsom to answer the phone. Okay. That was the point we were making before the commercial break. Yeah. He's the big grower in the southern San Joaquin Valley with about 160,000 acres of mostly almonds and pistachios and pomegranates. Pomegranates. But, you know, one of the reasons they have a close relationship is when Newsom was facing the recall, Resnick stepped forward and wrote a gigantic check to Newsom to support his fighting the recall off. So you can see the money flowing back and forth between the big growers and Gavin Newsom, and Newsom has really not helped us at all on salmon.
You know, that's one that's one of the great sayings about California, is California is water where water flows uphill. And it's true.
Uphill towards money. Wherever the money is, the water flows in that direction.
Yeah. But still I insist that the vote is in the city. So it would seem like if you fight for animals, and there are a number of associations and groups that fight for animals and the environment, they do their fighting in the city. And that's where they win their battles.
We're actually fighting as much for families who have a fisherman who's the main breadwinner in the family, who's putting a roof over the family's head. We're fighting for industries all up and down the coast that service the salmon industry, whether they're boatyards or marine electronic retailers They may be hotels and restaurants near Santa Cruz, Moss Landing, Monterey, Bodega Bay that cater to visiting recreational salmon fishermen during the summertime. There's all kinds of businesses throughout the state that are going to be hurt by the closure of this salmon season. And while that's true, it still is not widely understood, I'm sorry to admit, across California that we've got a salmon decline issue and that the public needs to rally or could rally and make a difference here. We work to publicize the plight of salmon and try and educate the public, but it's difficult getting through to big enough numbers that care. I mean, I guess most folks' lives don't intersect with salmon, or they don't maybe appreciate the keystone role that salmon play in supporting the ecosystem. For whatever reason, we've had difficulty getting critical mass in terms of public support.
And I would suspect, you know, that those of us who live on cement, when it gets right down to it, we're not very cognizant of where our food comes from. And so when somebody starts talking about salmon, oh, yeah, I had salmon once. It was pretty good, or something like that. But they don't connect it. They don't connect the species to the environment in which those fish are raised or and served. And that's really the frightening thing, is that when city people lose track or lose interest in the environment, but gosh, who's going to stop, you know, who's going to protect the environment if not city people, when it gets right down to it? So how are we going to save? You guys have been doing a lot of work on focusing on what can be done to save the salmon. Where do we start?
I don't know where we start. Maybe where we end is we need to figure out a way to take over TikTok and Instagram and whatever other things are preoccupying anybody under 30, where they're looking more at their phone than they're looking around them at the natural world in California. And I don't know that that is the case.
Well, of course it is.
The majority of people.
But we all know it's the case. All you have to do is walk down the street and watch kids. And what are they doing? They're giving up their lives to TikTok, I guess. I don't know. So
yeah,
what?
So that's the landscape that we're working on.
And how do you capture their attention?
You know, I'm not certain. I've often wondered about myself. Why is it that when I grew up, I wanted to be outdoors? I actually didn't want to play football and baseball and basketball. I wanted to go hunting and fishing. I wanted to go trapping and I wanted to go hiking. I don't know why that is. I mean, I was born in a big city. I have no idea why that was. And how common is that for young people today? I don't know. I will tell you that as a native Californian, I treasure the natural resources in this state. They're in my blood. They're in my roots. That's why I do the work that I do, because I care. But I'm not sure how you cultivate that type of passion if it's not already there. I'm just not sure, Michael.
Yeah. I don't know either. How do you get their attention? Tough. But at any rate, there are things we can do that are substantive and can actually change and make it possible for salmon to survive if we're really focused on doing that job, as you folks are. So what can we do, John McManus from the Golden State Salmon Association? What can we do?
The first thing for people who care is somehow get yourself on our mailing list, at least. I mean, becoming a member is a great thing at $35, but even if you don't do that, get on our mailing list somehow, and we will loop you in and tell you what's going on, and we will also invite you upon occasion when we think it can make a difference to add your name, to make a phone call to the governor's office, to click here and send a letter to the governor or the senator or whoever we've got all that stuff set up like other advocacy groups. Mm-hmm. I think many of your listeners are familiar with that.
Sure.
But yeah, you gotta come under the umbrella before you can get looped in as to what's
going
on.
Right. Join the team.
Yeah, even if you're over on the sidelines and you're not smack dab in the middle of the field.
Hop to it. What about habitat? What can we do to improve the habitat of salmon in the Central Valley without getting into trouble with Stuart Resnick?
You know, it's interesting. There have been pretty good strides forward on habitat restoration over the last decade. When we first came along, we started to advocate for the restoration of side channel habitat all throughout the Sacramento Valley, especially in the upper Sacramento drainage. This is below Shasta Dam, around Redding and Red Bluff, all through that area. You get these little side channels that come off the main stem of the river, and they provide great rearing habitat. In some areas, they provide good spawning habitat. And that kind of caught on and became a thing. The federal government threw a lot of money at it, and there's been a tremendous amount of that habitat that, in fact, has been restored back to a natural condition. And it's good. It's good, but it's not the limiting factor here. The limiting factor is not habitat. It's this business about flow. It's this business about water temperature and having water in the springtime to get the juveniles safely down the river. You know, too often.
So just a sec, John. Let's back up because that spring flow really hits the nail on the head with respect to the conflict here. The salmon fingerlings need flow in the spring to get out of the Golden Gate, right?
That's right.
And yet those people who run the dams are going, I'm not so sure I'm going to give those stinking little fish any water because we might run out of water this year because that's what we've been doing is running out of water. So if I run out of water, the farmers who are going to need the water in the fall are really going to be angry with me.
That's exactly right.
That's what's happening. So is there a resolution to that? Is it possible to resolve that?
Well, you know, these dams hold humongous volumes of water. You've got over 4 million acre feet of water behind Shasta.
But not last year.
not last year. You've got the capacity there.
Yeah.
You have a similar capacity at Oroville. And then you've got lots of other dams that are 1 to 2 million acre feet each. Mm-hmm. So there's quite a bit of capacity available. It's just a question of, you know, how you manage it when you finally say no to the guy who just showed up last week and he says, I've got 1,000 acres. I want water for that. Hey, wait a minute. You just showed up last week. Yeah. We've got, you know, other customers. We've got other needs. Sorry, buddy. You bought 1,000 acres out in the desert? No, we're not going to give you water for that. It's not a reasonable use.
Yeah, that's certainly true. Question, would it be possible to really get an understanding of the life cycle of the fingerlings so that you could judge, you know, this week on Tuesday, between 2 and 3 o'clock, we're going to flood the rivers and help the fingerlings get the hell out of here.
Michael, it's interesting that you bring that up. That is quite a discussion that's been going on for about the last 5 years. There's been quite a bit of money that's poured into studying and answering those exact questions. There's also been money that's been put into basically putting traps out in the river. So when the little dinky fish start to move, you'll know exactly when they started and you'll know where in the river they are. And all of that is geared towards the idea that you just expressed so that you can release water to aid their out-migration. The problem is we have a pretty good idea of where they are and when they're there, and we still don't have the political will to open the dams and give them a shot of water that they need.
Well, that would, I think, would be something you could sell to people. I bet even farmers, maybe not Stuart Resnick, but I bet a lot of farmers would listen to that. Here's what we have to do, farmers. And if we do this right, we won't be bothering you all the time. And we'll have fish.
The farmers have been the main proponent of this approach. And yet, when push comes to shove and it's time to, okay, guys, fess up, open the gates, let the water go, all of a sudden, everybody's tight-lipped. Nobody has any extra water they want to donate. Remember, it's gold. People don't want to give it up. But, you know, the governor could easily say, sorry, boys, we're going to force you to give it up. And if everybody contributes two drops, it's not going to kill any one of you. We can spread the pain around, and everybody will get out alive. And yet, that's not even happening. And this governor has made clear that he has no interest in even trying to get that to happen, unfortunately. Remember the money that went into the recall.
Yeah. Stuart Resnick calls. Just... there goes our fish. Wow. Well, you know, we have to fight for the salmon because we have to have that salmon on the barbecue for Mother's Day breakfast and dinner. And there's nothing like it, ladies and gentlemen. John McManus, a senior policy director for the Golden State Salmon Association. Great talking with you. And thank you for doing God's work and watching over our fish. Because not enough people think about our fish or our wild animals or anything. Because when it comes right down to it, this is the Golden State. This is where the gold speaks. And everybody else listens. So we're left, as we always are, with a question, which is, can enough salmon be saved to have a salmon season in our future? Log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Make your case. Listen to the reruns of our shows. And thank you, John McManus, for joining us. And remember out there, Michael Olson's third law of the food chain, cheap food isn't. Thank you, John.
Thanks, Michael.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.